Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Welcome to the conclusion of our interview with biologist Dr. Rob Carter. Dr. Carter earned his PhD studying genetics at the University of Miami. He's with Creation Ministries International, and he is the editor of a new book, Evolution's Achilles Heel, and the co-producer of the DVD by the same title, Evolution's Achilles Heels, 15 PhD scientists explain evolution's fatal flaws. We are going to join that interview in progress. Again, that's with CMI's Creation Ministries International's Dr. Rob Carter. Junk DNA is a topic that we have discussed here often. I had a debate with Eugenie Scott, Dr. Eugenie Scott, a long time ago, back in the 90s, on this. And she claimed junk DNA was the best evidence for evolution. And Dr. Carter, I'm a Bible pastor. I'm a talk show host. I'm not a scientist. And she is. She's a physical anthropologist, PhD. But at the time, I said, Eugenie, don't you think we don't know enough? We're just at the beginning of the learning curve on genetics. This was in the 90s, to say affirmatively that this stuff is all junk. It has no function. And she utterly disagreed with that and said we knew enough to affirmatively say this stuff has no function, it's junk. So now we fast forward 15 years later. How did the evolutionists do?
She was in the dark ages. This is before the molecular revolution of the last 10 to 15 years.
Oh. And so you write about junk DNA, and the claim by the Darwinist was that only maybe 2% of our DNA was functional, the rest was junk.
Do you remember the vestigial organ arguments from the 1800s?
Oh, I sure do. About 100 vestigial organs left over from evolution in the human body.
That was a very important historical argument. It was a very influential argument. It turned out to be utterly wrong, but it convinced a lot of people that evolution was true.
Right.
This junk DNA argument is nothing more than a modern parallel of the vestigial organ argument. There are no vestigial organs, even like the appendix. We know so many different functions of the appendix, we don't even know what the most important function is.
And the tonsils. So, I had mine taken out. They used to take out your tonsils at the drop of a hat.
I had a tonsil operation in my 20s. This is in the late 90s. And they did not take my tonsils out. They just cut holes in them to open them up a little bit because they said, oh, these are important. These are part of your immune system.
Right. And so the Darwinist then would think that, well, these organs are coming and going, and evolution makes a lot of mistakes, of course. It's not a divine designer. And so your body's filled with scores of leftover mistakes from evolution. And that retarded science because so many glands and organs were thought to be useless. And it hurt a lot of people because many were removed. Now with DNA, you quote an evolutionary biologist from Scientific American who says that this may go down as one of the biggest mistakes in the history of molecular biology, the claim that it's almost all junk. Dr. Carter, I think it might be one of the biggest mistakes in the history of science.
It was driven by not just an agenda, but by the idea that evolution would do these things. And as we learn more and more about the genome, and now, okay, a caveat here. I am not going to claim that every single letter in the genome is functional.
Right.
I'm not going to do that at all because there might be broken things in the genome through mutation. There might be duplicated sections in the genome that you take a piece out. It's not going to kill you because you've got enough a copy of it. Your redundancy is not necessarily bad, but it doesn't mean it's necessary.
Right.
And because the genome is a three-dimensional shape, that changes shape over four-dimensional time, there has to be scaffolding. There might be portions of the genome that are just there as spacers, because if you put that there, it holds this gene over here next to this gene.
In other words, they're structural rather than informational.
Yes.
It reminds me...
structural still information is just not coding for protein.
Or coding for RNA, maybe. It's just part of the molecule. It reminds me of bookends or a doorstop. You might take a book and use it to hold open a door, and somebody could say, well, it doesn't have an informational purpose. No, but it still has a function. It's holding up the door. And if you have some nucleotides in your DNA molecule, because right there you need a bend, and the bend doesn't have to provide information, it just has to allow you to fold the chromosome right there, well, then that's still functional. It still has a function.
That's right. Now, there's a trick here, though. When you use the book analogy, we got to be careful.
Yeah.
Because the evolutionists for decades have been appealing to pseudogenes. It looks like a gene, looks like a book, but it's not because it's broken. It's a doorstop. It's not a book.
Right.
It's a gene that's broken. And at first glance, this is an intimidating argument. But as we have looked more and more at pseudogenes, we have learned that I can't say every single one of them again, but most of the classic examples have turned out to have a function, usually a very profound function. A lot of times a pseudogene, in fact, the vitamin C so-called pseudogene, the messenger RNA, or the RNA that's produced from that pseudogene, is a regulator for the entire system of genes that it's associated with. It has a profound influence on the others. No, it doesn't produce vitamin C necessarily, or it doesn't produce the enzyme that produces vitamin C, but it has a profound influence. We can turn the table on the evolutionists. They say it's a pseudogene. They say humans, chimps, and gorillas have exactly the same mutations. And I will just turn around and say, if it has no function, why is it exactly the same?
Why is it conserved? Right? Why is it conserved?
It hasn't mutated since.
Of course, right?
And because if it's just junk, it's free to mutate. It has not mutated in what you claim is 10 million years. Obviously, because in biology, form follows function.
Mm.
It has a shape that is conserved. Therefore, it must have a function. Let's go look for the function. But their theory retarded us searching for functions for a lot of these things because they just assumed it was broken.
You just made an argument that I noticed could be made. I mentioned Darwin's Doubt earlier, a best-selling anti-evolution book of the last year by Dr. Stephen Meyer. And in his book, Dr. Carter, he quotes something from Michael Behe about a protein that is highly conserved, is hardly different at all from the plant to the animal kingdom, histones, that our DNA molecules are wrapped around these little protein histone molecules. And Behe points out that they're almost identical from green peas over to mammals. And they believe, because the intelligent design movement is old Earth, they think that animals and the plant kingdom have been different for hundreds of millions of years. And Behe went further and he said, when we mutate histones, they're very robust. You could mutate them and they still work. And you reproduce healthy organisms. And yet they're so similar. And that's a powerful argument that plants and animals have not been different for hundreds of millions of years. They're obviously recent on this earth.
Yes, or else they would have changed.
They would have changed.
There's another group of DNA, another type of DNA. There's ultra highly conserved DNA sequences. And then when they're working with these in mouse, they cut it out. They said this must be essential because it's highly conserved amongst all these life forms. They cut it out, and the mouse just kept on trucking as if it didn't need it at all. So is that junk DNA? It's not necessary for survival. Okay, it's not necessary for survival, but, you know, I don't need two arms to survive either.
Right.
And if you cut it out, if it's highly conserved, it must have an evolutionary function in evolutionary theory. But if you cut it out, the mouse is not harmed. The only way for this to be true is if these species are recent and this piece of DNA was inserted into all these different species, it's not necessary for survival, and yet it's there. And the only reason it's there is because it hasn't been there for a long time.
It hasn't been there for a long time, and it likely has some function.
Yes, it has some function, because a lot of things have a function that isn't required to survive.
Right. It might simply help you be more efficient in your use of complex carbohydrates or something.
Yeah.
The last thing on this point is the ENCODE project. that we celebrated when it came out a couple years ago in the journal Nature. About 400 researchers from around the world working together to tell us whether the letters on the DNA molecule are being transcribed into RNA. And it turns out not only are they, but each letter of the portion of our DNA that they looked at was transcribed into, on average, 6 different RNAs.
Yes, with different functions.
With different functions. So that the ENCODE project leader said, hey, so far, the DNA is active, and we've accounted for about 80% functionality already, and we've only looked at a handful of cell types.
Yeah.
The human body has so many thousands of different cell types, and we think it's going to go toward about 100% functional.
And it depends on how you define function. And
right.
Some of the evolutionists then don't like ENCODE. What they've attacked is their definition of function.
Right.
But even if you want to whittle down their definition a little bit, you're still going to arrive at a very high number, and it's going to be much, much, much higher than 2%.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that they say only 2% of our genome is functional is because if it's more than that, they can't account for it in 6 million years since our common ancestry with chimpanzees.
Well, that goes back to Haldane's dilemma, right?
Exactly.
And
it's derived from Haldane's dilemma. It's that if more than 2% of our genome is functional, we've got a mathematical problem with evolution. And they've known it for 60 years.
We did a 4-interview series with Walter Remine.
Good friend of mine.
Yeah, what a neat guy. He practically wrote the book. He almost single-handedly resurrected Haldane's dilemma in his biotic message. And so if anybody's curious about that, just our website, realscienceradio.com/dilemma or Haldane's dilemma. The problem is that evolution, if it's true, natural selection means you're killing off all the other organisms that don't have the improvement that you want in your DNA. And so Haldane pointed out that, hey, to go from apes to humans in a few million years, there's not enough time for millions of changes. We could only get maybe a couple hundred, or it was less than that, right? Changes.
About 300, I think he said. And he made a lot of simplifying assumptions
right.
in favor of evolution to say that.
Right.
And, you know, that has been, the argument has actually been amplified, because you talked about John Sanford earlier.
Yes.
Well, Sanford has now written a gigantic, and with some other friends of mine, he's written a gigantic computer program. It's the most sophisticated evolutionary modeling program anyone's ever written.
Mendel's Accountant. Yes.
And they have taken Haldane's dilemma and demonstrated it numerically. So Haldane did it theoretically. Walter Remine took that theory and really codified it and brought it out into beautiful light of day. And then Sanford put the nail in the coffin. Mm. And it's orders of magnitude worse than Haldane's worst nightmare.
It really is. And that's all open. You could go to mendelsaccountant.com. Actually, Dr. Carter, just minor trivia. Here at Real Science Radio, we registered mendelsaccountant.com, and we forward it to their website, mendelsaccountant.info. And we're offering it to them.
Well,
we can't
you.
Find the right person to give it to them. We'd like to give them that domain name. They've got mendelsaccountant.info, but it's all there. And research, you know, postdocs, scientists could use this numerical simulation program, and the results are devastating to the claim of evolution. And you could set the parameters yourself. You could decide what a deleterious mutation, how harmful it will be or not. You could decide the population size and the number of offspring and so on.
Yeah, the beauty of this program, Mendel's Accountant, is that they looked at all the other available evolutionary modeling programs. They got into the nuts and bolts. They said, oh, here are the assumptions these people are making. Let's not make that assumption. Let's make that a variable that the person has to type in.
Right.
And so, yeah, you can get, on a computer, you can get a system where you can see humans evolve in a positive sense over time if, like, every human female has 800 children.
Right.
And 798 of them die only because of natural selection, not because of random death.
Right.
Then, you know, those two that survive, okay, maybe you can actually get it to work.
Right.
The only way to get it to work is to make ridiculous assumptions, and that's the beauty of it, because we can now take Darwin and put him on a computer, and we've never had the ability to do that in all of evolutionary theory's history for the last 150 years. Hmm. We can now do it, and we can robustly test it, and when we do, it fails.
It fails in a colossal way, a catastrophic failure, which, in fact, John Sanford, you know, he's the neatest guy. Yes. Obviously, you know him better than I do, but humble, soft-spoken, brilliant, co-inventor of the gene gun, just brilliant scientist, and he's somewhat depressed because he can see through his insight that the human race is deteriorating. We're not evolving and getting better. Every species alive is deteriorating, and they simply can't last for a million years because of the fall. We're going to our genetic extinction eventually.
Now, I would not dare to put a date on the time of Christ's return.
Right.
But science tells us it's not going to be a million years from now.
It's not.
Because we can't last that long.
He would return to an empty earth, which would make a lot of liberals happy because they hate human beings. But there wouldn't be acorns either because everything would have come to a genetic death.
Bacteria might survive that long, but not much longer than that.
Because of
anything
their incredibly...
more complex than that, it's got a much shorter life expectancy.
Because of their incredibly rapid reproduction rate. Okay, and so perhaps the last topic, if we could discuss it, and we've talked about it a bit, but the ultra-complex gene processing. We used to be taught, I was taught, that one gene, one protein, one trait. One gene.
That's right. That's called the one gene, one enzyme hypothesis, which was a very good starting thing in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, and it's now naive genetics and naive neo-Darwinism.
Naive. We don't have a definition of the word gene anymore.
We don't know what a gene is. It's too wildly complicated.
You can take a piece of DNA and say, okay, here's where the protein starts. Here's where it stops. These pieces in the middle, they're called introns. They're not part of the protein. They're cut out and thrown away, and these parts are joined together. But now we know that any particular piece of a protein might be used in dozens of other proteins with completely different functions.
Hmm.
So that, you know, the first 100 letters of this protein might be the first 30-something amino acids in a protein, but those first 100 letters of the DNA can also be used in a dozen other proteins, and it's not necessarily the first part. So the genome, it turns out to be modular.
The genome
and
is...
we haven't quite figured it all out, but now we've got a glimpse and an idea of how about 22, 23,000 protein-coding genes can produce hundreds of thousands of unique proteins.
When they sequence the genomes of some very rudimentary, relatively simple organisms, maybe it's a worm or a fruit fly or a sponge, and they'd find out, well, it has maybe 20,000 genes or so, and they get to human beings, and they think they're going to find 100,000, 200,000, and they find 23,000 genes, about the same number of a number of much
jellyfish and a dog, yeah.
Yeah. And they think, well, how can it be? We're all made up of the same building blocks. But then it turns out that one gene, on average, a gene codes for multiple different proteins. Some of them, I've read, can code for 100 or even hundreds of different proteins.
Or the pieces of a gene can be incorporated into
the pieces,
hundreds of different proteins.
And how that happens obviously takes a code that's at a hierarchical level above the protein coding.
Yeah, I wrote an article for creation.com. It's called Splicing and Dicing the Human Genome. And it's a summary of the ENCODE project and what they discovered about all the, what was called gene splicing. It is so unbelievably complex.
It is.
In fact, going back to the evolutionist I said earlier, Mike Lynch, his paper, I've listened to some of his lectures, and I love listening to this particular evolutionist because he's willing to talk about things other guys are not. He has said that the mutation target for higher organisms is too big. We're so complex that any particular change could have a catastrophic effect. Mm. It's not necessarily true in a bacteria, But once you get all this gene processing and splicing and dicing and this four-dimensional genome and all this crazy stuff happening, then any particular change can have a more profound effect on the organism. Mm. And so the argument, how do you evolve a complex genome and a complex life if you can't change it without killing it?
Right.
You could, I mean, even something as complex as a fruit fly is incredibly complex. Now, human beings are at least 10 times more complex than that. But if you can't change a fruit fly without killing it, how do you change something that simple into something as complex as a human? That upward change is what we don't see in science. We see downhill changes. We see things breaking. We see things falling apart. Sometimes that produces a new trait, like, you know, sickle cell anemia in Africa. It's a new trait. It wasn't in the original creation.
It's a disease, but...
But it's a debilitating mutation.
It's debilitating, but it makes it so that you're not receptive to malaria.
Yeah, you're more likely to survive childhood malarial infections if you carry the sickle cell trait. Or in other words, you're more likely to get to reproductive age.
So that...
But you're still hurting. It's not fun. It's just better to be hurting than to be dead.
So, Dr. Carter, sickle cell anemia, if... It's so tragic if you have a child and they have sickle cell. How many times have you seen evolutionists argue that sickle cell anemia is evidence for evolution?
Often.
I've seen it so many times. It reminds me of this argument that if you lost all your teeth, you're better off because you can't get a cavity. So if you have a mutation,
that's really funny. I'm going to use that.
If you have a mutation and then your kids have no teeth, you say, well, they've improved because they can't get a cavity. And sometimes we break down, and the breakdown means you can't get another problem, but the breakdown itself is tragic. That's not an improvement in advanced functionality. That's just something that broke, which is part of the creation fall model.
Yes, but notice also the bait and switch. The reason evolutionists use things like sickle cell anemia and things like that as evidence of evolution is because they have a very lame definition of evolution, which is that evolution equals change over time.
Mm.
It's lame because I believe in change over time.
Right.
But what they do is they start with change over time, give me millions of years, I can have as much change as you want.
Yeah, right.
The assumption there is the millions of years, and the assumption is that you can actually change things to infinity. That's what Darwin said. Darwin said, I see no limit to the amount of change.
And breeders have, we now have centuries of controlled breeding, and professional breeders tell you there are brick walls. You're not going to just keep evolving taller and taller horses.
Some of the fastest horses in the world are no longer living, and the horses today are not as fast as the fastest ones ever.
Because there are natural design constraints that are particular to each genome. Dr. Carter, this we've been talking about the complexity. We'll have to end it there, but you use the word spliceosome. Is that it? Like gene splicing for a genome?
Yes.
The spliceosome is all the information involved in deciding what chunks of genes need to be cut up and pieced together to create different kinds of proteins and enzymes. And
it's
that
like the genome is the sum of all your genes. The spliceosome is the sum of all the splicing commands that have to be applied to the genome to get all those proteins out of it.
The spliceosome. And so that is yet another Achilles heel of evolution.
Yes. And we talk about that in the book, Evolution's Achilles Heels.
Yes. And what a great...
discusses in the video Evolution's Achilles Heels, the hour and a half long documentary.
Dr. Carter.
A lot of it is also on our website, creation.com.
This documentary, if someone needed to pick one video available today to show to a friend who believes in evolution, or to show to a friend to strengthen their faith in God, our creator, the God of Abraham, Jesus Christ, our creator, and to discount the misinformation of Darwinism, this video has got to be the most effective video available today, Evolution's Achilles Heels by CMI. And you were the co-producer, is that right?
Yeah, that was my original brainchild about 4 years ago. I didn't realize when I had this idea that I was going to be one of the main people actually doing it. I said, hey guys, here's an idea, go run with it.
Yeah, they
said, Rob, it's all you, go.
Right.
So I took my science background and became a movie director somehow.
Yes.
And we've been getting a lot of really good reviews and a lot of good comments.
Wow. Well, it deserves to be the best-selling creation video out there. It is tremendous. We plan to stock it at our store here at Real Science Radio. And I want to thank you. What an honor, Dr. Rob Carter, to have you on the program. Hey, your article on Noah, what's your article titled, Mitochondrial Eve and the Three Daughters of Noah? Is that it?
My video is called Mitochondrial Eve and the Three Daughters of Noah.
Do you think perhaps in a month or two we might be able to do an interview about that video? Just a tremendous, encouraging video affirming the history of the book of Genesis from modern genetics. Do you think we could do that?
I would love to, but just so the listeners know what might be coming,
yes,
I'm going to claim that there's abundant evidence for Adam and Eve, Noah's flood, and the Tower of Babel event in the human genome. Unlike that video, I'm going to update it because the video is 3 years old.
Okay, that sounds great. All right, Dr. Rob Carter, thank you. What an honor. God bless you.
You're welcome.
To share this interview with a friend, just go to our website, rsr.org/Carter or /Rob Carter/Achilles heels. However you want to do it, you'll find it. You could share that with a friend. Our website, realscienceradio.com, is abbreviated rsr.org. We encourage you to get the video, Evolution's Achilles Heels, and you could get it from us at rsr.org. Just click on the store and then the science department. Also, our video on the global flood. This has become our best-selling resource. It is a half-day seminar put on video. It's beautiful to look at. It's compelling. It's intriguing. It's all about the scientific evidence for the flood. A careful look at the book of Genesis. I think you'll love it, or your money back guarantee, 30-day money back guarantee. So this is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork.
Hi, this is Bob Enyart. At Real Science Radio, we have a great science store. You can get great science materials from us, DVDs, debates, books, online, realscienceradio.com. Click on the store or by calling us 1-800-8-ENYART. So here's a list of what you can get. DVDs from Illustra Media that we carry, The Privileged Planet, Unlocking the Mystery of Life, and Darwin's Dilemma. And then there are the two fabulous DVDs from Dr. Carl Werner on Evolution, the Grand Experiment, Living Fossils. You'll want to see those. And then Spike Passaris, formerly with the U.S. Military Space Program, What You Aren't Being Told About Astronomy. And then there's the BEL debates, Bob Debates an Evolutionist, Dr. Eugenie Scott on DVD, and a book, Does God Exist?, Bob Enyart debates atheist Zaketh, a psychologist. We also have two DVDs on our seminar, Does God Exist? And then Mount St. Helens, the explosive evidence for catastrophe. We also have our debate on the age of the earth, where I got to debate a mathematician from CU up in Boulder and a geophysicist on this MP3 CD. And finally, my favorite science book, In the Beginning, by Dr. Walt Brown. Just call us at 800-8-ENYART, 800-836-9278, or check out our online store in the science department, either at kgov.com or realscienceradio.com.